Hello, folks. This is Will Aitchison. I'd like to welcome you to May 2015's First Thursday podcast. At the Labor Relations Information System, we try to track all cases decided involving public safety personnel issues, try to at least scan them, if not read them. And once a month, we do this podcast highlighting the most important or hopefully the most significant decisions in the public safety workplace. Police officers, deputy sheriffs, troopers, firefighters, corrections employees, and the like. Today we have a bunch of cases that I want to talk about, and so let's get right into it. And let's start with a decision out of Washington's Public Employment Relations Commission on the negotiability of workplace cameras. Guess what? It's not a police case. It's a firefighter case. And it doesn't involve body cameras, but the principles are likely to be the same principles you see if and when we get that first case involving the negotiability of the installation of a body camera system. And we are going to get that first case, of course. So what's going on up in this Washington case? This involves a fire district outside of Seattle, Snohomish Fire District Number 3, and an assistant fire chief becomes aware that there's four missing radios. No one knows how they went missing. And so what he did after unsuccessfully attempting to search for the radios is he called the auditor's office in the state of Washington to report that the radios had been stolen and consults with his local police department. In his case, the local police department is the city of Monroe, Washington Police Department. The replacement value for these radios was $4,400 each, so any theft here would have been a felony. The Monroe Police Department assigns a detective to investigate. He decides that what we really ought to do is set up kind of a sting operation, and that would involve installing secret cameras in the area where the radios had previously gone missing. And that's what the detective did. He installed two cameras, one focused on the equipment rack where the missing radios had been stored, and the other on a door where individuals would enter and exit the area. These weren't completely private areas. They were inside the employer's workplace, but they were not like the living quarters of the firefighters, or certainly not a bathroom or a bedroom or anything like that. So he installs these two cameras, and the cameras were put into a small Pelican box, as it's called, and placed inside a locker, and only the detective had access to the locker. The footage that was captured by these video cameras was stored on an internal hard drive located inside the Pelican box. The opinion doesn't say so, but one would have to assume that these were motion-activated cameras in some fashion. The fire department didn't have any access to the footage. The only entity that had access to the footage was the local police department. In fact, the fire department didn't have any access to the video cameras. So what the detective does, once he's got this little setup going, is he places a radio, one similar to the ones that were stolen, places it out on the equipment rack as bait. That experiment fails terribly. And it fails terribly not only because the radio wasn't stolen, but a firefighter strolling by saw the radio there and said, "Whoa, that radio shouldn't be there," picked it up and turned it in to the employer. So rather than finding a dishonest employee, what this sting operation finds is an honest employee. Of course, by the time all that happens, the local, it's IAFF Local 3315, learns about the video cameras, demands that they be removed from the workplace, and files an unfair labor practice complaint alleging that the installation of video cameras in the workplace required prior bargaining. And while the unfair labor practice proceedings are ongoing, the employer removes the video cameras either because it thought it should or because the experiment was clearly going to fail now that everybody knew the video cameras were there, or for whatever reason. This goes to an administrative law judge for Washington's Public Employment Relations Commission, and he reviews the state of the law. State of the law both at the national level, what do we see on workplace cameras from the National Labor Relations Board and from courts, and also he reviews what we see in state of Washington case law. And for some reason, there's kind of a pretty good slug of Washington cases. There are five cases in Washington involving the negotiability of video cameras. And what this administrative law judge says is essentially three things. He says, number one, if images from video cameras are being taken for disciplinary purposes, it's negotiable. That's number one. And it, in this case, of course, it wasn't for disciplinary purposes. It was part of a criminal investigation. And therefore, that points to the non-negotiability of the cameras in the fire station. So question number one, are these images used or potentially used for disciplinary purposes? The answer to that is yes. Then you've got a negotiable event before the cameras can be installed. And if no, then maybe you don't have a negotiable event. Number two, says the administrative law judge, who's responsible for the cameras? If it's the employer, more likely to be negotiable. If it is an outside law enforcement agency, as it was here, less likely to be negotiable. Number three, says the administrative law judge, is there an expectation of privacy in the area where the cameras are? Let me put a little footnote to that one. There are a bunch of cases about the negotiability of the installation of cameras in completely public locations. These come out of the private sector. So, for example, you could have a camera that's installed in a parking lot where everybody sees the camera. The question is whether or not that's a negotiable event. And there have been cases that have held that in the absence of any legitimate expectation of privacy, it's either less likely to be negotiable or not negotiable at all. So the administrative law judge in this Snohomish Fire District case looks at all three of these factors. They all point to non-negotiability. The footage here wasn't used for discipline. The cameras were installed by a law enforcement agency as a result of a legitimate law enforcement purpose, and they weren't taking images in a public area. And the ALJ says not negotiable. So what lessons do we learn out of this in terms of body cameras? Well, the one that I think everybody who's listening to this is keying off of is the third of those factors. Is there a legitimate expectation of privacy? Because the whole idea is that body cameras will be used in areas that aren't private. They'll be used out on the street where anybody can, and today is, recording their own images. And does that mean, because body cameras are and will be taking images that are open to the public, does that mean that we don't have a negotiable event? And this case out of Washington doesn't address that issue. It just says, look, this is one of the factors. But I got a prediction for you. I think what is going to happen is that at least the impact of the installation of body cameras will be negotiable. What impacts? In particular, discipline, the use of body camera images for discipline, will be a negotiable event. And I also suspect whether or not officers are able to review the images taken by body cameras before completing reports and giving statements will be a negotiable impact as well. So I think when all is said and done, when these body camera cases start coming down, and they'll start coming down by the end of this year, there's one that's percolating through the system down in Riverside County right now in California. When these cases start coming down, I'll predict we're going to see that there's at least something negotiable about body camera systems, and maybe several things that will be held to be negotiable. And what that means in the context of an employer that has an obligation to bargain is the employer will have to bargain with the union about the body camera system before it's implemented. And what does that mean? Bargain in that context means whatever it means in your jurisdiction. If you're in California, it means you have to go through the meet and confer process if you don't reach agreement. And in a state that has binding arbitration, like, say, Washington, where the Snohomish Fire District case comes from, it's a binding arbitration state. Bargain means that you sit down, you negotiate, you talk about body cameras. If you can't reach agreements on whatever the mandatorily negotiable impacts of the system are, an arbitrator decides the result. And most states with collective bargaining are binding arbitration states. So there you have it, unfortunately not a straight-on body camera case, but a body camera-like case that gives us a feeling for some of the considerations that labor boards and courts will take into account in deciding whether the implementation of a body camera system is negotiable. You probably notice that the whole system of police discipline is under attack right now. You've certainly seen that in Baltimore, where there have been complaints from managers and social critics alike that Maryland's Peace Officers Bill of Rights gets in the way of disciplinary investigations and criminal investigations. You can remember, for example, the mayor of Baltimore on the night or the day after the Freddie Gray incident, that she publicly said many times, as often and as loudly as she could, that they couldn't get the story from the officers because Maryland's Bill of Rights had a delay built into it before you could ask an officer a question about an on-duty incident. The facts frequently haven't gotten in the way of debates like this. For example, nobody raised their hand in that press conference and said to the Baltimore mayor, how did the Bill of Rights get in the way when 5 out of 6 officers gave statements before the end of the night? The facts don't typically get in the way, but that hasn't stopped the pressure. You've seen a couple of very conservative editorial writers for the New York Times. They both have pretty firm roots in the Republican Party. One named David Brooks and the other named Ross Douthat in the last few months write opinion letters that say the big problem with policing today, the big problem is police unions. And the big problem is that police unions have the ability to challenge discipline. All of this really goes back to an article that was written by another conservative columnist, this one in The Atlantic in early December of 2014, a guy named Connor Friedersdorf. It really wasn't, in truth, much of an article. He was just putting together a whole bunch of newspaper clippings from around the country of people who complained about the results in police arbitrations. Friedersdorf, though, focused on the Oakland Police Department and what he considered to be some pretty egregious results in arbitration, where officers who had been discharged for excessive force got their jobs back in arbitration. To Friedersdorf, and later to Brooks and to Douthat, the problem was binding arbitration, a secretive system, they describe it, where all advantages are held by the union and not public employers. And everybody pointed at the broken Oakland system. Well, here's another example of the facts not getting in the way. Because as all of those drumbeats were starting, in fact, there was an independent court-appointed audit of the Oakland disciplinary system, an audit conducted by a very well-respected lawyer. And he came out with his results a couple of weeks ago. And his judgment, it wasn't that binding arbitration was the problem. His judgment was the Oakland police disciplinary system was broken. They weren't doing adequate or timely investigations. They weren't following their own rules. They didn't have adequate rules. And his judgment was the Oakland City Attorney's Office was doing some pretty bad lawyering. not getting in touch with witnesses until the night before, the day of the hearing, hiring outside counsel for the case only 24 hours before an arbitration is supposed to be tried, not calling expert witnesses when they should have, that sort of thing. That, of course, undercuts what this trio of columnists have been saying. And by the way, Friedersdorf publishes an anti-police union column seemingly now about once a week, and the Atlantic monthly magazine gives him a big forum to do that. None of these three have gone back and said, whoops, we got it wrong. Oakland doesn't give us the argument we thought we had against binding arbitration. In fact, they just doubled down on their attacks on binding arbitration. So we have this system, it's a milieu, an environment today, where we see pressure on police disciplinary systems coming on one hand with respect to procedural rights, as may be contained in a peace officer's Bill of Rights, and on the other hand, the basic right to appeal discipline, to appeal unfair discipline. Both of those are being challenged right now in the big public discussion. Well, an offshoot of all this is what we're seeing in the courts. And in the courts, what we are seeing is an increased use of what is known as the public policy exception to arbitration. Here's what's up with it. Arbitration is thought to be final and binding. Series of decisions from the Supreme Court saying, you know, arbitrators have the right to be wrong on the facts and wrong on the law and have their decisions upheld. And the reason is because you and your contracts say their decisions are final and binding. You have bargained for an alternative form of dispute resolution. Don't come to us if you think that arbitrator got it wrong. We're going to hold you to your bargain. The exception to that is where an arbitrator's opinion or exceptions is either procured through dishonesty, bribery, whatever it might be. The rare case where an arbitrator actually exceeds her or his jurisdiction, the authority given them under the collective bargaining agreement, or most commonly the exception you see litigated today, is that the arbitrator's opinion produces a result that is contrary to public policy. And what we see now around the country are cities and counties that fire law enforcement officers, and there's a firefighter case or two here too, but they're primarily police cases. They fire a police officer, for example. The arbitrator says, nope, got it wrong, reinstatement, and then the employer files a court challenge to the arbitrator's opinion, saying the arbitrator's opinion violates public policy. Well, we've got a new case that's come down out of the Illinois Court of Appeals that I think is a very good example of how courts react to these public policy challenges to the finality of arbitration decisions, at least how courts are reacting now. That reaction may change if courts get swept up in this public discussion about police discipline, but for now, courts are hewing pretty close and tight to some long-established rules concerning the public policy exception. Okay, so let's get into this Illinois case. It involves a police officer by the name of Scott Oglesby. He works for the Bloomington, Illinois Police Department. And he gets called to a school one day when he's on duty. The local school officer isn't available. Oglesby isn't very familiar with anybody who works at the school or, you know, the special programs that may be at the school. He's just the guy who catches the call. When he arrives at the school, he reports to the principal's office and is directed to what the principal describes as a timeout room. He wasn't given any information about whatever situation resulted in him being called to the school other than there was a disruptive student, and he was not told that the incident involved children in a behavior disordered classroom. So what Oglesby does is he gets into the classroom, resolves the first incident basically by talking a little bit sternly to a child. Turns out there's a second incident, a child that is really destroying a classroom, tearing it apart. The child is being physically restrained by a psychologist who has him in what sounds like a bear hug. I guess this is an approved form of restraint for children in these sorts of settings until the children calm down enough to be able to converse about a situation. The psychologist hands the child over to Oglesby. There's a brief struggle, and Oglesby picks up the child by the front of his jacket, not his neck, but the front of his jacket, picks him up and talks to him in a stern tone, and then eventually moves him away into a separate room. The employer fires Oglesby and fires him for using excessive force on this child. And there's lots of testimony about, in the arbitration hearing, lots of testimony about what Oglesby did. Of course, as you might imagine, you have the outraged parents. This officer grabbed my son by the neck, and something that was proven to be untrue. But you've got the outraged parents. You have school administrators who kind of come down on both sides of the issue as to whether Oglesby was out of line or not out of line. You have other officers who say Oglesby did nothing wrong. And the arbitrator sifts through all of that. It's a long hearing. And the arbitrator reinstates Oglesby and gives him a one-day suspension for not writing a use of force report, which he should have, but otherwise found that he acted entirely in accordance with the department's rules. The employer then challenges the arbitrator's opinion and says that we can't have this. It violates public policy. Now, here's the important part of this case and this doctrine. The court starts off by saying, what is the public policy exception to binding arbitration? The court says, to begin with, it's a narrow one. And only where the party challenging the arbitrator's decision shows that the decision contravenes an explicit public policy. What does explicit mean? It means we have to find that public policy in our Constitution, in a statute, or in a rare case, even in a court decision. So we need a clearly articulated, specific public policy that this arbitrator's decision violates. And the city says, well, we got one. It's the welfare and protections of minors. And the court says, not good enough. The court says, here, all the arbitrator does is to hold that the use of force on this child, described by some witnesses as excessive or overly aggressive, the arbitrator just said that that use of force, and described by other witnesses as being perfectly compliant with department policy, the arbitrator decided that this use of force didn't warrant termination, where in the arbitrator's judgment there was no misconduct and there was no violation of police department policies that resulted, and there was no injury to the child. In other words, what is it? What public policy could possibly be violated by a police officer doing their job correctly? Now, you may disagree, city, with the arbitrator's judgment that this officer did his job correctly. But while that's interesting, that's not the basis for a public policy challenge. That's just you disagreeing with an arbitrator's factual findings. And you can't do that when you have final and binding arbitration. We have to accept the arbitrator's findings as a given. Now, the city also argued that the reinstatement of Oglesby violated public policy, the public policy in favor of protecting children, because the arbitrator failed to make any findings about the likelihood Oglesby would repeat his actions. And the court says that's just simply wrong. No finding about Oglesby's remorse or likelihood to reoffend could be made by the arbitrator, because the arbitrator, she didn't find he did anything wrong. So why would she ever go down the road of any likelihood to reoffend? But what's going on in this case is courts are simply not opening the door to challenges to arbitrators' opinions, even in situations where they may disagree with the arbitrator's conclusions. And by the way, I don't think this court did. I think this court thought the arbitrator got it right. But there's other cases where a court will just explicitly say, hey, if we were the arbitrator here, we'd decide this a different way. Courts don't want to open the doors to challenges to arbitrators' opinions on that basis. And why not? Is it some sort of favoritism to unions or something like that? No, and actually it really doesn't have anything to do with labor relations, if you think about it. We have arbitration everywhere in our lives, right? You bought a car lately, you may well have agreed to arbitration of disputes between you and the dealer. Have you gotten service from Comcast or lack of service from Comcast? I was on the phone with them 3 hours last night for a small problem, so it's sticking in my head. Chances are there's an agreement between you and Comcast to arbitrate any disputes. You have a credit card, you bought a house, taking an airline trip. Arbitration is everywhere in our lives. What happens if courts start to open the door to legal challenges to arbitrators' opinion? What happens to court dockets? They explode, right? That's why courts don't want free appeals of binding arbitration. And I think, unless this political wave that I've been talking about, unless it totally overwhelms the court system, I think you're going to continue to see courts have this very firm reluctance to overturn an arbitrator's decision. Well, those were two fairly long discussions. I want to follow it up with a pretty short discussion. This is another case out of Illinois, but it involves something, I don't know why, but this case brought a smile to my face when I read it. This one involves the city of Springfield, Illinois, and the police union there, which is the Patrolmen's Benevolent and Protective Association. They've had a contract for a long time, and the contract has for a long time contained a purging clause with respect to discipline. And under this purging clause, any letters of suspension would be purged from an officer's files 5 years after the suspension was issued. Chance to give officers a kind of a new start in a disciplinary sense. In 2013, the city and the association enter into a memorandum of understanding that modifies that purging clause. And the MOU does a couple of things. It calls for purging instead of 5 years, 4 years will be the threshold for suspensions. And also calls for expunction from personnel files, purging of all files with a finding of not sustained, unfounded, or exonerated. Now, this MOU was signed by the chief of police and the association's president, and they essentially hammered out this deal. They hammered it out in the presence of an assistant city attorney, or as they're called in Springfield, corporation counsel, and a deputy chief, police chief. They were all present at this meeting, all four of them that produced this result. Now, at about the same time, a couple of other things happen. The first thing that happens is the city's new mayor issues an executive order that mandates that the city's labor relations manager has to be a party to all MOUs. All right. a little parenthetical there. This is something you see pop up with employers with some degree of regularity, where you get it, and it's usually triggered by a new HR director, labor relations director coming in and discovering that there are all these MOUs out there in the field, police department, fire department, roads department, whatever it might be, that HR has had nothing whatsoever to do with bargaining. And so the new HR director will want to, depends on your point of view here, either consolidate power in HR over MOUs, or at least consolidate information in HR so that HR knows what everybody else has been doing. Usually it's the consolidate power. People in HR or labor relations, not ununderstandably, take the position that, look, if the city's going to be agreeing to anything that's a mandatory subject of bargaining, we ought to at least be part of the process of reaching that agreement. So, at any rate, you see this from time to time where you have a new mayor, new HR director, whatever it might be, come in and say, okay, from now on, any MOUs have to be approved by me. And that's what happens here. The second thing that happens in Springfield at about the time this MOU is being negotiated is that there's a request for internal affairs files filed by a citizen under what's known as the Freedom of Information Act in Illinois. And the city has to answer this FOIA request, Freedom of Information Act request, has to answer it by saying, we don't have some of those files, and the reason we don't is we purged them from the personnel files of the officers who were involved. When the city gives that answer, it's not satisfied with the answer. The mayor's not satisfied with the answer. So what does the city do? It stops complying with the MOU. It stops yanking things out of internal affairs or personnel files after 4 years. And that results in the association filing a grievance challenging whether or not the city is complying with the MOU, and the city, not willing to let any rust form on itself, files an unfair labor practice complaint against the association, claiming that the association did not negotiate the MOU in good faith, and that the MOU violated Illinois' law on records retention. I'm a lot more concerned about the first. What's the allegation of bad faith bargaining here? The allegation of bad faith bargaining is that the association should have known about that mayor's executive order commanding that HR or the labor relations manager be involved in all negotiations involving MOUs. This goes to what's called in Illinois the Labor Relations Board, and the Labor Relations Board dismisses the city's complaint. What about that allegation of bad faith bargaining? What the board essentially says to the city is, look, you sent people to negotiate this MOU. You sent a corporation counsel, someone from the city attorney's office, out of the police department. You sent your police chief to negotiate this MOU. They've negotiated MOUs in the past that you comply with. You can't assume that the association should think for any reason that your negotiators don't have authority. In fact, the association is right to assume that unless you notify them to the contrary, that this sort of discussion with a police chief and an assistant corp counsel and a deputy chief, this sort of discussion is well within the authority of those people to resolve by entering into an MOU. But the city says, but what about our executive order from the mayor? And Illinois' labor board answers, well, yeah, it would have helped you if you'd actually told the union about it. But you didn't. you didn't publish that executive order in a form where the union saw it before entering into the MOU. Finally, what about the city's argument that this violates the records retention law? And the labor board essentially says that's not in our jurisdiction. We don't think these things, purging clauses, violate public record statutes. We think there's ways around that. But really, that sort of discussion has to be held with whatever the body is that construes the free and applies and enforces the Freedom of Information Act in Illinois, and that's not us. So, interesting case. Does bring kind of a smile to my face, because I've been down this road many times of HR or labor relations saying, oh, we need to be party to everything, and discovering all of these MOUs and letters of agreement, letters of understanding that may have been entered into for many years, and wanting to get out from under them. And the results are pretty much always going to be what they were in this Springfield case. Those are going to be upheld unless the employer has provided explicit direction to the union as to which city officials and only which city officials have authority to enter into these sorts of agreements. I want to move over to California for a moment and talk about the latest pension reduction case that we've seen. This comes to us from the California Court of Appeals, and it involves the city and county of San Francisco. That's a combined government there, city and county of San Francisco. And it deals with a COLA, cost of living adjustment, to pensions. So here's kind of background that you need to understand what goes on in this case. In 1996, specifically, November 5th, 1996, voters in San Francisco adopted a charter amendment that called for what is described as a supplemental COLA benefit, a supplemental cost of living benefit, where pension benefits would escalate according to a formula that depended upon the CPI, the Consumer Price Index. And that stayed in place for a long time as part of pension benefits. In 2011, so right after the peak of the recession, city voters amended the charter to, among other things, say that the COLA could only be paid if the pension system was fully funded based on the market value of assets for the previous year. Well, that's in essence saying there's not going to be a COLA, because very, very few pension systems are fully funded. A group is formed. It's called Protect Our Benefits. It's a political action committee that represents the interests of retired employees. And they file a court challenge looking to overturn this ballot measure. And their argument is this violates our vested contract rights to the COLA, and our contract rights are protected under what's known as the Contracts Clause, clauses of both the federal and California constitutions. Just a little bit of background here. This is where the action is on pension reductions, is whether or not there was a promise made to employees that if you put in your time, you do your service for us, a certain benefit would result. That promise is thought to be a contract. And there is a provision, and I think it's in every state constitution, or almost every state constitution, certainly is in the United States Constitution, that prohibits governments from impairing the obligation of contract. And so the way these pension cases go is courts say, look, if, in fact, there's a contract that is impaired, that's unconstitutional. That reduction in the pension benefit is unconstitutional for the employees who were protected by the contract. Now, you can always modify a pension prospectively for employees who were hired after the effective date of an ordinance or a ballot measure. What you can't do is modify that benefit retroactively. And next month, I will describe at some length a decision from the Oregon Supreme Court. Just came down a couple days ago, otherwise I'd have it on this podcast, that attempted to modify a pension benefit both for retirees and for existing employees and for new hires. I'll talk about that later. But back to the San Francisco case. So what does the Court of Appeals do with this pension case? The court says, first of all, when we look at the supplemental COLA, we look at the ballot measure that created it in 1996, it was a promise. It was an unconditional promise that employees would receive this COLA. Therefore, there was a contract that was created with employees who worked any time after 1996 and prior to 2011, and that contract cannot be enforced. In other words, the cutback on the supplemental COLA can't be enforced for anybody who worked after November 8th, 2011, and was hired prior to, who worked after 1996 when the supplemental COLA was put in place, and who was hired before 2011. So everybody in that great big block of time, that 16-year block of time, has their supplemental COLA protected for life, says the court. Who doesn't have the supplemental COLA protected? Anybody who retired prior to 1996 when the COLA was adopted, they don't, because of course there was no contract with them. They were already retired. They didn't put in any time after they were retired. And the other group are people who were hired after the 2011 ballot measure. They don't have the right to the supplemental COLA unless the retirement fund is fully funded. This is pretty traditional analysis by this court, a little bit different than that Oregon case I'm going to describe next month. But this is pretty traditional analysis, not a surprise, but this is a case that may well go up to the California Supreme Court for decision. Did you know you can be fired for running for political office and you won't have a First Amendment claim? Believe it or not, that's not just the law in a few places. There have been decisions from the United States Supreme Court that suggest that, and from courts of appeals all over the country. And that's a lesson that was learned firsthand by Micah Phillips, who's a dispatcher for the Dallas, Texas Fire Department. And Phillips began working for the fire department in April of 1999. And so he had about 12 years on the job when in 2011 he announces his candidacy for what's called the Dallas County Commissioner's Court. That's kind of like a board of supervisors or county board of supervisors or the like. The city immediately fired him from his job as a dispatcher, citing a provision in the city charter that any employee who runs for elective office within the county, and I'm quoting, shall immediately forfeit his or her place or position with the city. Phillips files a free speech lawsuit saying, hey, running for office is kind of like the ultimate political speech that should be protected. And the case ends up before the Federal Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals. And the court goes through a litany of prior decisions from not just the United States Supreme Court, but prior decisions it had issued and other courts had issued, and says that, look, there are four governmental interests that support laws limiting public employees' political rights. The first is that employees should administer the law in accordance with the will of Congress, the will of government. That means we need to have employees who will impartially execute the laws, and therefore we should not be overturning any sort of statute that prohibits employees from running for partisan political office. Second, the court says employees should not appear to the public to be influenced by either partisan or nonpartisan politics. We want our public employees to be uninfluenced, or at least to appear to be uninfluenced by political considerations in the way they do their job. Third, the court said employees should not be employed, and I'm quoting now, to build a powerful, invincible, and perhaps corrupt political machine. And fourth, laws prohibiting employees from running for office actually protect employees, allowing them to be free, and I'm quoting here, from express or tacit invitation to vote in a certain way or perform political chores in order to curry favor with their superiors rather than to act on their own beliefs. The court says, look, we've taken into account these four factors in the past, and we have upheld rules that are called resign to run rules. You want to run for political office? You've got to resign your public job. We think that these four interests that government has in basically a non-politicized workplace, we think that these interests override the free speech rights that employees may have to run for office. Here's the tagline on what the court says. The court says, we have time and time again favored governments against First Amendment challenges to laws more far-reaching than the cities here. Put simply, the government interest in fair and effective operation of the government justifies regulation of partisan political activities of government employees. The message here, of course, is that if you've got this sort of ordinance or statute or whatever it might be, the solution is going to be a political one. The solution is going to be to change the ordinance or the statute rather than to rely on the court system to enforce some sort of First Amendment right to run for office. I want to conclude with a little bit of a roundup as to what's going on bargaining and what's going on in terms of the cost of living. First of all, the CPI continues to be in pretty seriously depressed mode. We have been throughout 2015 seeing CPI numbers at around the 1% level. That's as low as it's been in an awful long time. You can go to the federal government and look at some projections of the cost of living. The Congressional Budget Office webpage has some projections. There's others that are out there as well. Those projections are still hovering in the 2% range for 2015 and 2016, but I can't help but think that the downward pressure that we've seen so far this year, a downward pressure that is largely the product of decreased fuel costs and a housing market that is not yet spiraling out of control, I can't help but think that that downward pressure is going to produce a CPI by the end of the year that's closer to 1%. Now, as to public safety settlements, we continue to see a bunch of them, continue to see a bunch of arbitration decisions, and the trends that we've seen earlier in the year are holding. And the trends are that we're seeing wage increases in around the 2.5% per year range. So wage increases that are actually above the CPI, a little bit, we're in a little bit, I think, in the way of a catch-up mode. We're starting to see something, the early signs of something that is pretty serious, though, and something that may distinguish police from firefighters in terms of wage increases. We saw it before, and I'm starting to see tendrils of this out there, and that is we got a massive police recruiting problem in this country, and it's being recognized all over the place. You may have seen San Diego, City of San Diego, reopened its contract voluntarily to put some more money into the contract to try to stem recruitment and retention problems. There's an open discussion in the Dallas, Texas Police Department as to why it is so many officers are leaving Dallas and going to other departments, and about the need to do a serious adjustment of the wage structure in Dallas. And of course, in New York, the big news in New York is the number of applicants for police jobs in New York is seriously down. It's down by well into the double digits. If we continue to see these problems in recruitment and retention in policing, you can expect to see the solution being putting more money into wages. I really think that what's going on right now is the whole public discussion of policing has greatly impaired our ability to recruit police officers. And as a society, we don't seem to understand that. We don't seem to understand that if you paint police with this broad brush that we've seen of being racial bigots inclined to use excessive force, we don't seem to understand that that has a consequence, and that that young women and men are not going to want to become police officers. And I think what's going on right now is we're seeing people voting with their feet and voting with their feet for other professions, particularly at a time when the economy is, if not booming, in a period of steady growth, when there are plenty of other jobs. I saw this discussion about a week ago with a professor. I think she's the chair of one of the criminal justice programs in John Jay University in New York. And what she was saying is, you know, the way we really can get at these problems with police behavior is we need to hire police officers who are in their mid-20s who have college degrees. That's who we need to be hiring. And I saw that, and I just smiled. Okay, I mean, I get why you want to hire people who are further along in their lives, and I've seen the studies that show a positive correlation between college education and policing. I understand all of that, but are you going to be able to hire those people in the current environment? Or are they going to take a look at the job of policing and say, I think I really don't want to do that job. I can earn as much money or more elsewhere, and I won't be subjecting my family to what I see other officers subjecting their family to right now. I think as all of this develops, we may see by the end of 2015, and maybe even sooner, recruitment and retention pressure on police wages, where we're going to see the average police wage increase perhaps even double or triple the CPI. It's early yet, so let's just wait and see on this. But the more I see reports around the country, and they're all over the place, that there are vacancies in police recruit classes, the more we're going to see that pressure. Okay, that's it for First Thursday for May 2015. We got a seminar I'd like to invite you to coming up next month in June in Las Vegas. It's a seminar on the rights of police officers, the constitutional and statutory rights of police officers. We are in the process of printing the 7th edition of our book on the rights of law enforcement officers. It's going to be the text for the seminar, and I think it's going to be a fun time going through these kind of the myriad of developments under the law with respect to the employment rights of law enforcement officers. And with that, this is Will Aitchison signing off.